Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Memes, The Guardian's regular Brexit podcast. I'm John Henley. Now, recent Brexit news has been dominated by three big whats. First, what kind of transition does Britain want to bridge the gap between Brexit Day and the start of a new deal on its future relationship with the EU and thus avoid the chaos of a cliff-edge exit? Second, what's going to be in the raft of up to a dozen new position papers that the government has confirmed it's finally going to be publishing over the next few weeks? And finally, what size of financial settlement, or divorce bill as it tends to get called here, will the Brexiters in the government and Parliament be willing to pay? Now, here with me to chew over all this and perhaps to conclude that it's all tied up with another much bigger and overarching what, namely what, at the end of the day, does Britain actually want from Brexit, are my guests today, The Guardian's Brexit policy editor Dan Roberts, Brussels bureau chief Dan Boffey and political editor Anushka Astana. So first then, the transition deal. Now, there was an awful lot of fuss about this last week. First, the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, and his backers, let's call them the gradualists, said there was a cabinet consensus around the idea of a kind of a long drawn out exit, a sort of continuity option during which for as long as 3 years, the UK would continue to pay into the EU budget, abide by the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice and accept free movement. All with the aim, of course, of ensuring a smooth Brexit with as little damage to UK business and jobs as possible. But then Liam Fox and his cabinet allies effectively said there was no such consensus, and there basically wouldn't be one, because accepting free movement and the authority of the ECJ would basically be breaking faith with what people voted for in the referendum. And the official government position, remember, remains that a final deal can still be thrashed out within 2 years of the Article 50 talks. So, Anushka, first off, if I can start with you, how real is this cabinet split on the transition deal? Where does the Prime Minister stand on it? And who do you think is going to come out on top?
Well, I think there is a split to some extent, but it is also true what Philip Hammond said, that there is now a consensus around the cabinet table around the idea that there will be some form of transition. The divide is about what that actually means. Now, Philip Hammond probably doesn't go quite as far as this when he describes it, but essentially would quite like us to stay in a pretty similar position after spring 2019 and possibly within that period still be negotiating a final deal. What the Brexiteers want is they want the final deal to be negotiated by that point, but also for there to be an implementation period, you know, a slope, if you like, down towards the final, you know, end line in which companies, etc., do not face a cliff edge. And so that perhaps is what Liam Fox is talking about. And in fact, I texted a Brexiteer minister, quite senior, yesterday to ask about this very point. You know, are there differences on transition? And they simply replied, it's the same as in the Lancaster House speech. And if you remember, the Prime Minister in that speech basically said, I want the final partnership to be agreed by spring 2019, and then there will be a phased implementation phase. Now, there is a divide because I think there are more and more people within the cabinet who feel somewhat emboldened by the idea that actually we have to go down the Philip Hammond route. People like Amber Rudd, I suspect Justin Greening is on that side, Damian Green, Greg Clark. And the question is, how much power do they have? I do think it was very interesting that Nick Timothy, Theresa May's former chief of staff, did an interview the other day. It was actually pretty unremarkable in many ways, what he told us. But one thing he clearly did tell us, he's still in touch with the Prime Minister, and he thinks there should be no backtracking on Brexit. That said, I know someone very senior in Downing Street who thinks the opposite. So the truth is, Theresa May is still being pulled in different directions. And I don't know what you think, but most people don't really know what her actual view is.
Well, I was going to ask about that because, I mean, do we know where she stands and also how much clout she carries? Because I think it's very noticeable, isn't it, that this whole debate inside the cabinet and outside has been going on while she's been on holiday.
Yeah, well, that's very true. A lot of people saying that while she was away, Philip Hammond took his opportunity, although I'm sure it is to at some extent sanctioned what he's doing. Certainly Damian Green, the Deputy Prime Minister, has said that it is sanctioned. I mean, she is not in a strong position. Let's be absolutely clear about that. She lost the majority in that election. One MP said to me when she was standing in front of the 1922 Committee of Backbenchers, he said, it felt like here she was, our prisoner in front of us. And they know that it doesn't take very many people to pull the rug from under her leadership. And there are two big groups in the Conservative Party who could do that. One side, the Brexiteers, a very, very big group of people who tell me that they are worried that transition means you are kicking this into the long grass. Mm. And on the other side, the Remainers, who frankly weren't very strong before that election, but now are big enough to also cause her trouble.
Yeah, so caught between a rock and a hard place. Dan Roberts, so, I mean, the options for this transition deal seem basically to be either continuity, which would basically mean prolonging the current status quo between the EU and the UK, and that presumably by extending Article 50 talks or at least agreeing to keep things as they are until the new relationship is settled. Second, there's you could think about a kind of an off-the-shelf option, which might entail signing up to the European Free Trade Association and then staying in the European Economic Area, though, of course, there's problems with that. It would involve accepting free movement, and it would also imply negotiating some kind of customs union arrangement, because EFTA, of course, isn't in the customs union. And the third option, I suppose, is a completely bespoke deal, cut out completely, especially for the UK. Any thoughts on what's most likely, and with the Article 50 clock ticking, of course, what's most feasible?
Yeah, I think they look like options inside this weird UK bubble where we're negotiating only with ourselves at the moment. But I think in reality, in the bigger world where there is actually someone on the other side of the table that might also have views about this, they really just collapse into one, your first option, I think, which is to continue as we are. The reason I say that is because I think if we spend too long negotiating a transition phase to get us to a point where we have a lasting settlement, we just, you know, all disappear up our backsides. I mean, this goes round and round in circles, and we end up spending time negotiating the transition where we could be negotiating the actual deal. And so I think any transition has to be really simple. There is perhaps a chink of this, what you called the off-the-shelf deal, where we go into EFTA as a sort of purgatory phase, and we accept largely the existing rules. The trouble with that is that even that requires negotiation. It requires the agreement of the other EFTA members, let alone the EU27. Mm. So my personal feeling is that the Prime Minister is right to distinguish between transition and implementation phase. A transition phase basically means we stay in while we scratch our heads a bit longer and work out where we eventually want to get to. Implementation phase is a much sort of shorter, sharper cliff, not quite a cliff, but a steep
slope. Yeah.
When we do know where we're going, which we don't at the moment.
Okay. And Dan Boffey in Brussels, where does the EU stand on this then? I mean, what kind of transition deal has it said it might accept? And where's your sense of where this might end up? I mean, is the EU willing to contemplate the idea of, you know, a continuity transition where basically everything stays the same for some considerable time?
I mean, to be honest, that's exactly what they would like. They foresaw the idea of a transition period, you know, well ahead of the UK government talking about it seriously. When the UK government was talking about, oh, we'll have a deal wrapped up in the first 2 years, the EU already saying we're bound to have a transition period, bound to need one. Bound to need one just to get ratification of any deal through the 27 member state parliaments anyway. No, so the EU have always thought that they need one. And the simplest thing is just to slightly fudge at the end and just carry on as we are. with the Brits continuing to pay in and continue to accept the jurisdiction of the ECJ and all the regulatory and budgetary and supervisory instruments. And then Barnier constantly talks about, whenever you hear him in the press conference, when he talks about transition period, he talks about how then we can phase the new arrangement in at the end. That would be really quite difficult. If we joined the EEA, then we joined the EEA on the terms of the EEA. It's kind of, you know, they're quite set terms. If we just continue as we were, fudge it legally, and at the end have a clear withdrawal agreement with the EU, we can phase in the new customs checks or single market checks at the end, and we can phase in, on the UK side, we can phase in restrictions on free movements of people. So that's how they use it. They say it could be very time limited. It could be no longer, and the European Parliament actually said in their resolution, no longer than 3 years. The EEA is, as we've discussed, is a problem in terms of it's outside the customs union. So you'd have to start talking all about
which
that.
Which might end up being just as complicated as
absolutely. And as Dan just said, as Dan Roberts just said, you know, you don't want to waste time trying to think up something brand new. Why not just continue, have an agreement about how that 3 year period is going to work, when we're going to phase in the various bits and bobs at the end of it. And that seems the most simple way forward for them.
Anushka, can I just come back to you for a second? I mean, how acceptable is that going to be to the pro-Brexit camp in the cabinet and in parliament? It would obviously entail very much maintaining the status quo, i.e. continuing to pay into the budget for the time being while this transition period was going on. It would entail continue to accept free movement. It would entail continue to accept the jurisdiction of the European Court. How might that play out?
Not very well. Just to give you an example, so the backbench group that essentially represents the Brexiteers, although there are a few Remainers who have come on board now, is called the European Research Group. And they published a paper recently by one of their MPs, Charlie Elphick, who's the MP for Dover, on the question of the customs union. And in particular, the impact on ports like his own constituency. And I thought there was some quite interesting language in it, because on the one hand, it's very clear that the ERG would see anything like what you're suggesting as kicking Brexit into the long grass. Mm. It would not be acceptable to them. On the other hand, in his report that was signed off by the ERG MPs, he basically concedes that it's almost impossible to think that we would have a deal by March 2019. He points out that there are a lot of political things happening in the rest of Europe over that period, that the EU don't particularly want to get there in that time, and that we also have parliamentary considerations here to get through. And so the basic argument that he appears to be making is not that we should therefore go down perhaps a sensible transition route in which we essentially stay within the EU or the EEA for a longer period. He's saying we've got to get ready to crash out completely. And I feel that there is a bit of movement along the Brexiteers towards trying to soften people up for that position, and that a lot of them would frankly prefer that than a drawn-out process that takes us out. The one really interesting thing that has happened is what's going on in the Labour Party. I mean, the Labour Party is in such a difficult position. A senior shadow cabinet member told me they're essentially, they've got a position of studied ambiguity, i.e. they don't really know what they're going to say at the moment. You know, they're just kind of taking us along the ride. But Keir Starmer, exclusively to our very own Rowena Mason the other day, revealed that what they are going to do is push probably to stay in the single market during transition. And that really does change things, because the parliamentary mathematics here means that if the Labour Party is against Theresa May, and we know that there are some staunch Remainers on her own benches, it becomes very hard for her to win votes.
Dan, you wanted to come in on the question of the Brexiteers.
On Anushka's first point, I would definitely amplify that it seemed to me at first this idea of no deal was a largely of crashing out with no deal was a largely tactical measure pushed by Davis and others, because they felt that unless we gave the impression that we had alternatives, that we would have no negotiating leverage. That sort of was undermined by the election result and ultimately by the fact that many Europeans didn't seem to believe that it was a realistic option. But I do agree with Anushka that we're hearing a new sense of weariness now about crashing out. Rather than just sort of threatening it as a tactical measure to give us leverage, this is increasing what people are realizing, that this is the only way that Brexit might happen. Hmm. That the alternatives, as we've just outlined, are so convoluted and don't really amount to Brexit.
Hmm. Hmm. That's slightly alarming idea. OK, let's turn now to this question of the position papers. This was a big story very recently, and the divorce settlement. Now, the government denies it, of course, but there have been plenty of voices in the UK and on the continent who've accused it, basically, of not really engaging with the substance of the Brexit talks so far, of failing to put very much on the table. It's only published a handful of policy papers, for example, against a whole raft from the EU side. But now we've been promised a rash of new position papers over the coming weeks, which should include the UK's position on how to deal with the whole question of the Northern Ireland border, how it would like to replace the customs union, and how it would like to calculate the exit bill, probably without actually naming the exit bill, but at least how it would like to calculate it. And speaking of that bill, Number 10 also this week dismissed as inaccurate speculation a newspaper report at the weekend that it was prepared to offer about £36 billion, 40 billion euros or thereabouts, providing the EU agreed to discuss the future relationship alongside Article 50, which of course it's so far refused to do. Dan Boffey, can I start with you on this one? Is it fair to say that the EU has been unimpressed with the UK's efforts so far? And what do you think might be expected in Brussels from this new batch of papers?
Unimpressed, yes, to a certain extent, in that they were quite clear about what Britain wanted before the general election. Then the general election threw everything into some doubt. Did the UK still want to leave the customs union and the rest? And what the rhetoric around the bill was all sort of clear. Talk of that we owe nothing at the famous Downing Street dinner. Mm. So not impressed by that. But to be honest, the EU have also been playing this up hugely, that the idea that the EU have a strong tradition of doing this. When they're negotiating with somebody, they like to show up the opposing partner. When during the Greek crisis, they would always like to show the Greeks as not quite up to it, not quite up to negotiating the future. And they've done quite the same with Britain. So the famous photograph of Barnier and Sabine Wyatt, a deputy, opposite David Davis and Ollie Robbins, and they've got loads of papers and the other side haven't got any papers. I mean, they thought that through. They're not daft. This is a bit of a tactic. That said, there's a bit of truth to it. They feel that the UK haven't produced enough position papers. It's very much the EU way to have a paper from which you can work on and talk. It's very important for the EU to have these position papers because they have to get agreement from all the 27 EU member states and then write it down and then all sign off on it. That's why their papers are so important for them. On the EU, UK side, when you speak to officials when they're over here, they're a bit frustrated with the EU's position. They say it's inflexible. They say we don't need to have these position papers to make progress. We can talk through the EU's positions and make progress that way. I think the UK has been, however, slightly shamed into putting out these position papers. The EU are having lots of fun with it. So the EU side will be pleased that this has happened. I'll be very interested to see if there is a finance paper, which is absolutely what Brussels desperately wants. Mm. And we're very, very fearful that the Brits weren't going to comply. And that will hopefully unlock things a bit more when we come to October and sufficient progress needs to be seen to be made. Mm. Of course, it depends what's in that paper.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Yes, Dan Roberts, what do you think this sudden flurry of activity from the UK side suggests? And can we read anything into the order in which these papers are being promised, namely the fact that, you know, that something on the Northern Ireland border and something on the customs union we're told are going to be coming very soon?
Well, I wouldn't get into the sort of weeds to the extent of trying to work out which order they're produced in. I would also agree with it mainly being for show. They're stung a bit by this criticism that they're all at sea and don't know what they're doing. I think there is also a tactical game going on by the Brits, which is to try and show that everything is linked up together, to try and show that, of course, you can't solve the Northern Ireland border question until you know what the customs arrangements are. And of course, you can't agree a final financial settlement until you know when we're finally leaving. And this is a very deliberate pushback at the EU insistence that we sequence everything and we deal with it one at a time. And I had a conversation with somebody who was chatting with David Davis only recently about all of this. And he was left, my source was left very firmly with the impression that Davis sees transition and money as inexorably linked. And the reason being that if they can push a transition past the current EU budget phase to 2019-20, then a lot of the divorce bill, quote unquote, becomes moot, because we'll be making these ongoing payments while we're in transition, and we will have effectively given notice 5 years previously. So there'll be a lot less to pay.
So it'll be less of a bill and more of a kind of ongoing membership
yes,
fee.
Yes, yeah. And I think that's how Davis sees this all shaking out, that they'll have one big hurrah at the October European summit. Well, they'll do this dance where we say we can't talk money until you've talked trade, and the others say vice versa. But they do it all at once so that we can all have safe face and be seen to be in keeping with the negotiating mandates. But effectively, what we'll say is we'll have a transition that lasts for, say, 3 years, and that'll mean that we'll eat through at least 2/3 of the money you think you want off us. Then you meet us halfway on the rest, and Bob's your uncle, and we're all there. I think Davis sort of feels that fudge is the way forward.
Yeah. Anushka, is that going to be acceptable? Because, particularly on the question of the exit bill, it's extremely delicate, isn't it? Because the Leave campaign famously promised this great sort of Brexit dividend of £350 million a week. And the EU has been widely reported to be expecting a settlement in the order of £60 billion or greater. And yet we have prominent leavers here on the radio and the television saying really loud and clear that even £36 billion, which is the latest figure to have surfaced this side of the channel, which is a bit more than half what the EU is rumoured to be asking for, would be completely unacceptable and completely balmy, as Owen Paterson said this morning. How is this going to play out?
Well, I think to some extent it's those very same people who are making the arguments towards crashing out behind the scenes who are saying that something like that would be unacceptable. I think the government itself accepts that there has to be an exit bill, and despite denials from Downing Street, it's the denials I will be sceptical about, not the figures that we've heard, the idea that we start at 27 and we go up to 36. The question is, how can they sell that to people? They'll be hoping that expectation management will help, because we've been saying that the EU are demanding so much more than that. They'll hope that we'll be far enough away from the referendum that it might become more acceptable. They might hope to carve it up in a way that seems more palatable for voters. But you are right, we cannot get away from the fact that a very, very key part of that Vote Leave campaign was the idea that the British taxpayer will be getting a lot of money back. And there are lots of people here, perhaps most vocal among them, someone like Chuka Ramunna, who would like to talk about the £350 million every day if he could, who will be ready to, hit out any suggestion of what Vote Leave were promising before. Now, what Vote Leave people would say was, hang on, we were not policymakers, we were campaigners, and, you can't hold the government to that. But it is a very, very thorny area.
Mm. Okay. Okay. Well, to wrap it up then, we're now well over a year, obviously, since the referendum, more than 6 months since the Article 50 was triggered. Dan Roberts, in between the squabbling in cabinet over the transition deal, given this raft of new upcoming position papers and the whole debate around the bill, are we any closer to beginning to see the outline of what might be an eventual deal? What kind of prospects that the UK is actually exploring and wanting at the end of this?
I think so. It seems apt, very common at the moment, to quote Churchill, and I can't remember the exact quote, but something about the end of the beginning. And it feels like we are making some progress. I think I've been very critical in my writing of the government negotiating with itself rather than with the EU, but it is an important important first phase, and arguably one that perhaps should have taken place before the referendum, certainly before Article 50 was invoked. Nonetheless, it is finally happening now, and I think the behind the scenes, as I just outlined to you a minute ago, I can see chinks of how the government thinks it can get through the next few months. So, yeah, I am perhaps less gloomy than I was at the end of the last negotiating round, which was a total farce. I think at least when we get... I think the October meeting is concentrating minds. I think the Barnier strategy of saying, look, we can't go forward unless we have some common principles has at least sort of forced the Brits to start thinking about money and thinking about customs and trade in a way that we were just denying and sweeping under the carpet before.
Okay, and Anushka, finally, back to you. Late September, early October, when all this is going to come to a head in Brussels, is of course also party conference season. How is this all going to... How do you see it playing out on the domestic political stage?
I mean, I feel like we're on the brink of an enormous political battle that is about to commence in the UK. It will be constrained by what the EU would or would not accept. But I think with the Labour Party now seeing if there's any possibility that we remain within the EEA or some form of it, you know, for a transition period, with emboldened voices on that side of the debate across Parliament, with the Brexiteers lining up to push for us to actually crash out completely with no deal, I think there are going to be fireworks to some extent this autumn. And just don't lose sight, I don't think, of the Labour position, which is incredibly important. We did a story recently that did a poll of Labour members, and Labour members are overwhelmingly in support of the idea of trying to remain in the EEA, of trying to remain in the customs union, if that is even possible, and of a second referendum. Jeremy Corbyn may once have been a Brexiter, but he is also acutely aware of what his members are thinking. I say, who knows what's going to happen? At some point, we could have a general election, and in that case, we could have a change of government.
Now, it does certainly feel like it's all starting to really heat up. OK, well, that's it for this week. My thanks to Anushka Astana, to Dan Boffey in Brussels, Dan Roberts for joining me here in the studio. Please do subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. If you want to get in touch about Brexit stuff, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. And if you'd like to review the pod and be in with a chance of featuring in our weekly podcast column, do please email podcasts@theguardian.com. So that's it. Till next week, I'm John Henley. The producer is Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.